This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiswu Hib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
She was like a mother figure to me. When I came back from exile, I lived with her in her house.
That's Kingsley Makubela talking about the late Winnie Madikizela Mandela at her memorial today. Details next.
Also, at least 257 people have died as a military plane crashed shortly after takeoff today from a base outside Algeria's capital. And authorities in the DRC say they will boycott a UN conference in Geneva, saying descriptions of Congo's humanitarian crisis as catastrophic is false and gives the country a bad image.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the recent death of South African icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela at the age of 81 has awakened memories of the long struggle to end apartheid and achieve equality in the Rainbow Nation. Tributes from top South Africans at her memorial service today did not shy away from her controversial past, even as they underscored the continued importance of her struggle. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Winnie Madikizela Mandela, the South African icon who fought tirelessly, visibly, and at great personal cost to bring racial equality to South Africa, is being celebrated with vows that her struggle will continue. Wednesday's somber memorial in Johannesburg was the culmination of at least a dozen memorials held across the nation since her April 2nd death at the age of 81. Madikizela Mandela, a lifelong activist who served in Parliament for nearly two decades, was the second wife of Nelson Mandela, the man seen as the leader of the anti-apartheid struggle, who went on to become South Africa's first black president. The two divorced in 1996 after 38 years of marriage, most of it spent apart during his 27-year term in prison. President Cyril Ramaphosa, who will deliver the eulogy at her state funeral on Saturday, vowed to continue her legacy during a memorial Tuesday in her rural hometown.
Whilst we mourn Umama Winnie for her passing away, we are also here to celebrate her life because it was a life that was well-lived and selflessly dedicated to the improvement of the conditions of others.
Many South Africans, like struggle veteran Kingsley Makubela, regard Madikizela Mandela as a maternal figure. Makubela spent 9 years in exile as a member of the banned African National Congress and aide to leader Oliver Tambo. When he returned to South Africa in 1990, she cleared a room for him in her Soweto home.
She was like a mother figure to me. When I came back from exile, I lived with her in her house. And anyone that she regarded as a family, myself included, very protective. So that's how she was as a person.
But she paid a price for her activism, including an 18-month stint in solitary confinement and banishment to a rural town. She was also convicted of kidnapping and being an accessory to assault in the 1989 killing of a 14-year-old anti-apartheid activist who she suspected of being a police informer. Madikizela Mandela's bodyguard was convicted in Stompie Moeketsi's murder. Her death has invigorated the ANC Women's League, which Madikizela Mandela led for 10 years. On Wednesday, many women in the crowd at Orlando Stadium in Soweto wore duks, a traditional South African head wrap often worn by Madikizela Mandela. Daughter of slain anti-apartheid activist Chris Hani, Lindiwe Hani, said she helped empower South Africa's women.
There have been so many things said about Umama Winnie this week that honestly I have found quite unpalatable. Whether it's in the media or leaders, even by those that feel they are defending her, Umama Winnie does not need defending. Her actions are the reason that I can stand here as an independent, strong, and unapologetic black woman. Not only did she keep the home fires burning, she collected the wood and she lit that fire. She was fearless.
As the ANC said in a statement, Winnie Madikizela Mandela did not die. She multiplied. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Officials say a military plane crashed shortly after takeoff today from a base outside Algeria's capital, killing at least 257 people. No cause has been determined for what may be the country's worst crash and the world's worst aviation death toll in 4 years. The Soviet-designed Ilyushina 276 plane was mostly carrying soldiers and their families. However, an Algerian TV report said 26 passengers belonged to the Polisario Front, a separatist movement in Morocco's Western Sahara region. The destination was Bashar, a military base in southwest Algeria. Witnesses reported that the plane's right wing was on fire before the crash into a farm field near Boufarika military base, about 20 miles southwest of Algiers. TV footage and photographs showed the wreckage sending up thick black smoke.
The United Nations says it hopes the Democratic Republic of Congo will attend a donors' conference in Geneva later this week aimed at raising $1.7 billion for life-saving aid. DRC authorities say they will boycott the conference, saying the UN's description of Congo's humanitarian crisis as catastrophic is false and gives the country a bad image. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations reports more than 13 million people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are in need of humanitarian assistance. 7.7 million are going hungry. More than 2 million acutely malnourished children are at risk of dying. And 4.5 million people are displaced by conflict. Because of worsening conditions in DRC, the United Nations declared three regions in the country, the Kasai, Tanganyika, and South Kivu, as a level 3 emergency late last year. This is the world body's highest level emergency. A spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, tells VOA the DRC government's displeasure with this designation is based on a misunderstanding.
It's not a classification of the severity of the crisis. It's a classification that is internal to the UN system so that we mobilize, so that we are able to respond to the crisis as it is. I think it's important to stress that an L3 is an internal designation to make sure that we actually meet the need.
In other words, Lajerke says the L3 designation is intended to get humanitarian organizations to beef up their assistance activities so they are able to respond adequately to the crisis that exists.
That includes, for example, things such as ensuring that there is a deputy humanitarian coordinator in place. It is to make sure that staff, and there are hundreds of additional staff, UN and NGOs staff, which have been sent to the DRC so that they can implement the programs that we have. Now, what is important now is that we get these programs funded.
Lajerke notes the L3 emergency was declared for a six-month period and will expire on April 20th. The OCHA spokesman says the UN invitation to the DRC to attend the conference, which takes place on Friday, is still open. He says the UN hopes the government will change its mind and be present at the event. But whatever happens, he says the pledging conference will go ahead as the lives of millions of people are at stake and depend upon the generous response and support of donor countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe has released a list of individuals and international bodies that are welcome to observe the elections. Among the 43 are United States and the European Union. The announcement comes after years of sour diplomatic relations with the two Western powers. Reporter Kuzai Zenwash has the report.
Among the invited U.S. dignitaries are Senator Jeffrey Lane Flake and former U.S. Congressman Andrew Yang Jr. The election date has not been announced, but the state media and other bodies of government have hinted it will likely be in July. Andrew Makoni is the chairperson of the Zimbabwe Election Support Network.
What I've seen this time around is that the government of Zimbabwe has invited international observers from a cross-section of the international community. In the past elections, especially post-2000, there were very few invited observers. Observers were being invited from friendly regions and friendly countries.
Alexander Rusero is a political analyst. He says the government of Emmerson Dambudzo Mnangagwa, commonly referred to as ED, needs the recognition of foreign countries and international bodies. This comes after Mnangagwa elbowed out Zimbabwe's longtime leader, Robert Mugabe, through what some observers call an illegal military intervention.
If there is one thing the ED government is in desperate need of, its legitimacy and the endorsement precisely by the international community. And this can only be done when you are warming relations, when you are not hostile, but you are cordial. So it's quite a paradox that on one hand we have America, which last month ago renewed sanctions on Zimbabwe.
Despite the motive, Rusero says inviting foreign observers is a good move.
I think it's a plus on the part of the Zimbabwean government, the Mnangagwa administration, because what is simply demonstrating is that he's a man of his word. He's not grandstanding.
Makoni also supports the involvement of international observers, but with reservations.
In our view, the authority to invite election observers must be the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission and not government. We would have loved to see ZEC taking center stage in inviting these observers rather than the state.
Makoni's other concern is that the international community will not be able to send enough observers to cover the more than 9,000 polling stations that will be dotted across the country. He says local observers will cover all of them. Makoni urged the Election Commission to do away with the $10 accreditation fees for local observers, as that discourages local organizations from monitoring the polls. The election date is yet to be proclaimed, and official invitations are expected to be sent out soon. While all this is unfolding, parliamentarians are set to ensure that electoral laws meet the requirements of the Constitution. Makoni encourages all citizens of voting age to register, a process that is still underway. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
The World Bank has raised its 2018 economic growth forecast for South Africa. This takes it to 1.4% from a previous forecast of 1.1%. The improvement is attributed to increased confidence, global growth, and benign inflation. It's not the country's only positive economic news. Following months of downgrades, some ratings agencies are also reviewing their forecast for the country. From Johannesburg, Nadia Sami has the story.
Investor confidence in South Africa has grown in the past month and a half since the governing African National Congress ousted scandal-plagued former President Jacob Zuma. New President Cyril Ramaphosa has moved quickly to root out corruption and calm the jittery markets. Dr. Azar Jamin, chief economist at Econometrics, says the World Bank's revised 2018 forecast for the country from 1.1% to 1.4% is not unexpected.
Well, the 1.1% figure has emerged as being a very low forecast. Everyone else has tended to increase their forecast growth since the election of Cyril Ramaphosa as president. And that is because there's an expectation that as a result of improved business confidence, there will be an improvement in fixed investment, and with that also an increase in overall economic growth.
Last month, Standard & Poor's hiked its 2018 growth forecast for South Africa to 2%. That's up from 1%, with the agency saying Cyril Ramaphosa's presidency and the policy announcements he's making have been good for investor confidence, both at home and abroad. The World Bank has forecast the country's growth for 2019 at 1.8% and 1.9% for 2020. Its advice to the South African government is to stimulate competition as the country is constrained. Dr. Jamin says there are several factors to consider in this regard.
The first and foremost thing, and that is probably the source of greatest encouragement, is that business and the government need to work closer together and need to collaborate instead of the government seeing the business sector as being the enemy, which has been the case in recent times. That's under the Zuma administration. Secondly, we need to see an end to corruption and state capture. Thirdly, we need to see the government pulling the business sector more into capital investment projects to finance social upliftment and development.
Dr. Jamin believes the business sector should be drawn in as a means to transfer skills to the masses. He says large-scale deregulation, particularly in the small business sector, would also be a step in the right direction.
There is a myriad of regulations at the moment that are inimical to investment and business activity. In many other countries of the world, attempts are being made to actually make it easier for business to operate in South Africa. It's been going the other way.
Another area of concern is state-owned entities, many of which were pillaged and plagued by corruption during the Zuma years. In his State of the Nation address in February, President Ramaphosa invited MPs to put forward concrete proposals to fix these crucial arms of the state. Since then, he's fired several executives from power utility Eskom and the national carrier South African Airways in a bid to fix the parastatals. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 22 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. At least 257 people die as a military plane crashed shortly after takeoff today from a base outside Algeria's capital. Authorities in the DRC say they will boycott a UN conference in Geneva, saying description of Congo's humanitarian crisis as catastrophic is false and gives the country a bad image. And Zimbabwe has released a list of individuals and international bodies that are welcome to observe the elections. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Sub-Saharan Africa has the youngest population in the world, and it is growing rapidly. By 2030, the United Nations estimates the region will be home to a quarter of the world's 15 to 24-year-olds. How will African countries cope with this sizable new generation striving to study and work? Universities on the continent are already overwhelmed, and experts say the curriculum needs to be changed to better meet the needs of the workforce. For VOA in Dakar, Sophia Christensen has the last of three reports on efforts to reform higher education in Senegal.
Normati Ndoye weaves his way through Dakar's bustling Senegal market. He buys cheap clothes wholesale and sells them for a small profit. It's hardly his dream job. The 30-year-old has a university degree in physics and chemistry, but has struggled to find work. He says university did not provide him with the qualifications he needed. Normati recently started a part-time course in geospatial science and urban planning, what he hopes will be marketable skills in a city overrun with construction projects.
After my formation,
he says this training will open many doors for me. I can go into remote sensing, cartography. I now know how to make and interpret a map. Like most countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Senegal is struggling to employ its youth, especially when they are educated. In fact, 2017 government data shows that the unemployment rate in Senegal is highest among people with more than a secondary school education. Gilles Yabi is the founder of the Dakar-based West Africa Citizen Think Tank. He says in Africa, there is this incompatibility between the content of university programs and the needs of the economy. He says young people going into higher education expect a higher quality of life and easier access to jobs. but in many African countries, they are actually more likely to be unemployed. In Senegal, employment is concentrated in three sectors. Just over half of the working population is employed in agriculture. The service sector comes second, followed by occupations such as construction and mining. Yet, at Cheikh Anta Diop, Senegal's largest public university, more than a third of students are studying humanities, like literature and languages. Bridging this gap is part of Senegal's ongoing 750 million overhaul of its higher education system. With an eye to vocational training, the government is opening technical schools in each of Senegal's 14 regions. Two new universities are also under construction outside Dakar. One is devoted to agriculture, while the other, a shiny science and technology university, will be devoted to fields such as electromechanics, aeronautics, land management, and agribusiness. The expansion can't come fast enough for some. Moussa Diatta runs a furniture depot in a rundown warehouse tucked in the outskirts of Dakar. He received a government grant to earn his degree in banking and finance at a private institute, but has found little demand for his skills. He spends his days assembling dusty pieces of furniture.
J'aurais préféré faire quelque chose, mais pas les études.
Moussa says he wishes he had done things differently. He says he would have preferred to become a builder. I can't even see the point of having studied, he says, and I can tell you I'm not the only one. Now, at 30 years old, he fears time is running out to learn a new trade. And as an estimated 300,000 Senegalese youth join the job market each year, he knows the competition is fierce. Sophia Christensen, for VOA News, Dakar.
The White House says it's taken Chad off President Donald Trump's list of countries with restrictions on travel to the United States. Chad has been a U.S. ally in fighting militant groups, some linked to Al-Qaeda and some to the Islamic State in the Sahel region. The U.S. government said Chad was added to the travel restrictions list in September for failing to implement adequate security measures to keep terrorists out of America. The White House yesterday said a government review has found improvements. The U.S. says Chad has taken steps to make its passports more secure and also to share information on known or suspected terrorists. The travel restrictions still remain for seven countries: Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, North Korea, and Venezuela. The countries were listed in the third version of Trump's travel restrictions, which critics say unfairly singles out Muslims. Courts struck down the first two versions, and the U.S. Supreme Court will consider the legality of the third in the coming months. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Swohib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, the life and legacy of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, the giant of the anti-apartheid movement who died last Monday. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bunganyan in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook,
drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.